arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Are you ready for a podcast? Welcome.
Oh my God, that was very something.
Yeah, I got to come in with the exuberance because I'm not feeling very exuberant.
Gotcha.
This is the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Janelle.
I'm Vicky.
Did that get your blood pumping?
No.
Did you pump?
I'm just
the
startled.
Jams? Sorry, I had jock jams in my brain. Man.
Welcome to the show, I guess.
Here's a show for your ears.
Oh, yeah. We have a great show for you. Before we get started, we want to say a quick thank you to Side Street Studio Arts. We just did the Dark Matter show. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not sure if it's going to come out before or after this episode, but either way, it was super fun. Always a good time. So thanks
for that.
For that. And for Ghostly Podcast mm-hmm. for doing our sound, which is always lovely to see. C-Pat and Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Anything else off the top? We normally don't do stuff off the top, but I just didn't want to forget.
No. You know, that was the one live show that we've had so far. Don't know if we'll do another one, but
cool.
Never know.
Well, then let's head over to the newsroom. So, our story comes to us from CBS News.
I thought you said CVS News, and I was like, ooh. Love okay. A good pharmacy.
CVS News. All the news about the ointments you could ever need.
On a giant receipt.
So, a man named Jericho Labonte, 35 years old, was found on a yacht in the Columbia River, which is like through Oregon and Washington.
Okay.
They had to
yachting in Oregon and Washington.
He had to be rescued by the Coast Guard.
Okay.
Because he, I think, got thrown off the boat thanks to like some heavy waves. Turns out he had actually been wanted for leaving a dead fish on the porch of the Goody's house.
That's a crime?
Well, I think it's, I don't know. I don't know if it's like harassment or what the deal was, but it says he had allegedly left a dead fish on the porch of an Oregon home featured in the 1985 movie The Goonies on February 1st.
Okay.
And then he stole the yacht.
Okay, well, that's the big one. He stole the yacht.
Yeah. So then he stole this yacht and, like, went out into sea and was wanted on theft, endangering another person, unauthorized use of a vehicle, and criminal mischief. I think that might be the dead fish.
Yeah, I don't know if that's...
Apparently, he's also wanted in British Columbia on charges of criminal harassment, mischief, and failure to comply in an unrelated thing.
Going around leaving dead fish everywhere?
I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's what's going on in the world. That's all you need to care about.
Okay.
I saw The Goonies and was like, oh.
Very interesting.
Yeah, anyway, moving on.
Weird choice.
Moving on to Netflix and Kill. I feel like because of what we're going to be talking about today.
Okay.
I had the perfect choice.
Okay.
Which is Pepsi, Where's My Jet?
I did watch that.
which
was absurd.
Has been out for a little bit. It's on Netflix. So in the mid-1990s, Pepsi released this series of ads marketing their Pepsi Points promotion.
That was such a thing back then.
It was Coke Points, Pepsi Points.
Marlboro. Like all the cigarette companies.
That's still a thing.
Yeah, but now they don't even advertise or market it because it was actually towards kids back then. Like,
oh, yeah.
I had a Marlboro sleeping bag and a duffel bag and a cooler as a child. I had lots of stuff with Camel Joe on it. How am I normal?
Yeah. So they put these ads out, and at the very end of the ad, there is this little part where it says you can win a Harrier jet for 700,000 points.
Something like that, yeah. And a supposed astronomical amount, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And this 21-year-old business student, John Leonard, decides, I'm going to get that jet.
Part-time scammer. Yeah.
And he ends up getting this investment from a friend of his to like help him do this because they realize that you can actually buy the Pepsi points that you need.
Yes.
To get this
for
jet.
A few cents.
And he puts together this business plan, and Pepsi's like, we weren't serious about this jet.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't have any disclaimer.
No, not until after the fact.
So.
Yeah, when they added just kidding and mm-hmm. like changed the amount. So anyway, there was a huge legal battle, and is now, this is like a case that's taught to legal students, mm-hmm. About sort of misrepresentations and advertising. Yeah. And, it's a very interesting documentary. It's like,
and not Pepsi's kooky. First defense.
Yeah. Yeah. And
they've messed up quite a few times.
That's true. That's true. And can we also talk about the surprise cameo from Michael Avenatti? I know dude had a life before, like, the Trump stuff, mm-hmm. but it was just like, oh?
Yeah.
Dude just shows up out of nowhere? It's very weird. But I thought it was really good. I mean.
Mm-hmm. It was a little cheesy. Perfect for what it was about.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely gave me that, like, McMillions vibe. Yeah. Like, where it was.
The only thing, though, that I thought was kind of ridiculous is they had everyone try a Pepsi and a Coke, and no one really could figure out. I love that. The Pepsi, which one was Pepsi or Coke? I'm like, I can 1,000% like tell the difference. Yeah. Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
It was like 50-50 on like the people who couldn't.
They were also in a metal cup, which does change the flavor, but Pepsi's so much more sweet.
Maybe. I feel like it's been a while since I had a Pepsi. I don't really drink a ton of pop. Yeah. I kind of loved that too because it's very, I mean, the Pepsi Coke challenge, like mm-hmm. that was. Another marketing thing. I don't remember if it was Pepsi or Coke that did that, but I don't know. I loved everything about it. It was very fun, very nostalgic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All the 90s flashbacks.
Yeah, the commercials that they kept bringing up. I'm like, oh shit.
I know.
All the spokespeople they had. I was like, oh yeah. Beyonce was a spokesperson for Pepsi, wasn't she? Didn't remember that. Mm-hmm. I remember Britney Spears.
Yes. Yeah. Everybody. I mean, if you were the spokesperson for Pepsi, like, you made it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's called Pepsi Wars by Jet. It's on Netflix. Check it out if you got a little time.
Drink a Pepsi while you do it.
Yeah, or a Coke, whatever.
Yeah.
We don't tell you what to do. This is not part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. This
is super light.
Pretty mild, to be honest with you. So probably just light profanity.
Yeah.
That's as about always.
It. Yeah, this is so light.
Janelle, what are we talking about today?
We had to be light after our episode yesterday where we talked about all kinds of horrible things.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about fraudy things.
Okay.
All kinds of fraudulent fraudsters who are frauding all over the world.
My favorite.
This is going to be a blast from the past again, because that's how I do.
Same.
So let's get into the time machine. We're going to go all the way back to the 1800s.
Oh, okay. Like way back.
If you like American history, this is for you. If you don't like American history, take a nap. Keep it on, but take a nap.
I feel very...
We need them listens.
Very indifferent.
Yeah.
Some of it's fine. I mean, some of it's like interesting.
I'm not into U.S. presidential history.
But this is
an interesting aspect of U.S. presidential history.
I'm ready.
So we're going to go to the 1870s when Ulysses S. Grant was the president. And the U.S. was in all kinds of fucked up fuckery because this is post-Civil War.
Yeah.
This is right as Reconstruction is starting to happen.
Okay.
Now, Grant became president in 1869, and, like, the country was in absolute shit because he was, like, post-Civil War president. And
yeah.
We all know what happened. We all know that story.
Yeah.
Also, at this time, there was a lot of financial insecurity, not just in the South, but as a country overall, we okay. owed a lot of people money for assisting with the Civil War in France.
God damn it. Why do we owe anything to France?
France, Britain, who else helped us? There was a couple other places that helped us. The gold market was also fucked, which is what our dollar is backed by.
Okay.
So there was actually a gold manipulation scheme happening at the time to the degree that it caused a stock market crash known as the first Black Friday.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
The very first one. You know, it put us into a financial panic. So Grant's presidency was marred with all kinds of bullshit financial issues and fraud issues from the jump.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about the most important fraudulent happenings of his presidency. And then I'm going to tell you everything else. And you're going to be like, what the fuck? How did this guy become president twice?
Okay. I mean, I wonder that about a lot of people.
Right? Almost a third time.
Oh my, what? Wait, what?
Yeah. They tried. This is before there were term limits.
Oh.
Term limits didn't happen until, was it FDR?
Maybe.
Yeah. He's the only one that ran for
seems so late. President.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay.
Wow. Maybe it was Teddy Roosevelt. It was one of the fucking Roosevelts. I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway, maybe it was Teddy Roosevelt. I don't fucking know. Now, during the Lincoln presidency, it was actually when this fraud started.
Okay.
So right before Grant. Whiskey distillers were in cahoots with Treasury agents to cause a little mischief and mayhem.
Okay, that's not where I thought this was going.
Yeah, because this is the 1871 whiskey fraud.
Okay. Interesting.
So distillers and treasury agents were in cahoots, and the distillers were trying to get little to no taxes paid for their whiskey. They would bribe the agents with money, pay them 35 cents per gallon, and then the agents would stamp the whiskey barrels as full tax being paid.
Okay.
Now, they were supposed to pay 70 cents per gallon in taxes to the government. So instead, they would pay the agents half that amount, and they would just stamp it.
Okay.
As paid in full.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, we know that post-Civil War, no one was paying attention. So they were able to kind of do this with absolutely no repercussions. Like, people were just bribing left and right.
Oh,
and
it
was totally fine.
Oh, yeah. Bribe everybody.
The group started to really pick up steam and rake in the dough by 1871. And then by 1873, they were a full operational crime syndicate, close to the likes of, like, Al Capone kind of a situation.
Okay.
Members of the whiskey ring were bringing in anywhere between $45,000 and $60,000 a year from the scandal.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's a lot of money back then. That's
yes.
Even more now.
Huge. Yes. Yeah.
That's like some very rich stuff. Missouri revenue collector John McDonald was actually appointed by Grant himself. And when he got into the position, he was like, all right, let's do this bribery scandal. He was totally fine with it.
Okay, I guess. Right man for the job.
Well, Grant didn't know
that
there was a bribery scandal going on. So he's just appointing people to these positions.
Oh.
And when he got in there, people were like, yeah, this is kind of like a bribery situation. Are you chill with that? And he's like, yeah, totally.
Oh, my God.
So he actually reached out to Grant's private secretary, Orville Babcock. Unfortunate
what a
name.
What a name.
And they worked together to make sure that everything was smooth and covered up and that nobody would find out that was higher up. Now, in 1874, Benjamin Bristow was appointed to Secretary of Treasury by Grant. Bristow was a former lawyer, a Union military officer, and he was, like, very, very eager to make a name for himself. He was actually one of the few lawyers at the time to bring a case against the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh.
Now, we're talking about, like, right when the Ku Klux Klan was getting full power.
Good for him.
Post-Civil War, like, burning down the South. He also advocated for civil rights and free speech for African Americans, specifically in Kentucky. That was something he was working on as a lawyer before he was appointed Secretary of the Treasury.
This sounds like I like this guy.
He sounds like a decent human being.
Yeah.
He drastically wanted to reorganize the Treasury Department when he got in there. He wanted to abolish corrupt offices, get rid of supervising architects, dismiss a bunch of the comptrollers and subordinates for insufficiency. He wanted to, like, clear
total
it out.
Overhaul, yeah.
So Bristow really shook up the entire Treasury Department, and he especially shook up the detective force and the Consolidated Collection District of Customs and Internal Revenue Services.
Okay.
So he was really, I feel like he'd be a man of the people now. He dismissed over 700 people in the IRS.
Jeez.
He was like, goodbye, and got rid of 700 people.
That's a lot. That is a lot of people.
Yeah. So he really wanted to make things fair and have people pay taxes and all of that, but not unjustly look at people and more like organizations.
Yeah, he would very much be a man of the people today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, in December of 1874, he wanted to send out agents to St. Louis to investigate some small treasury-based crimes that he kind of caught wind of. Now, in fear of being found out, Orville Babcock persuaded the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, J.W. Douglas, to revoke the order. So, right from the jump, it's like, that's a little suspicious.
Okay. Like, clearly they're trying to, like,
it's like a little too
redirect,
evident, sir.
Yeah.
Bristow decided to figure out a way to do it anyhow.
Okay.
So, with assistance, he was able to get some informants into St. Louis to kind of see what the hell the deal was. Why was Babcock and this other dude trying to stop him from going to St. Louis?
Yeah.
The secret investigators reported to Bristow evidence of a massive ring of conspirators between revenue agents and whiskey distillers.
Okay.
The informants came back and stated that whiskey was being labeled as other things like vinegar. Things were being falsely recorded at a lower proof. Other things were not being paid for and being stamped. And every single thing was stamped by a revenue agent. So they know that somebody from the revenue agency was doing this.
So it's not even just like the tax thing anymore. It's just like completely concealing.
Yeah.
What's it? That's wild. Wow. Yeah.
Just trying to every conceivable way to get around paying anything, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So they estimated that it had cost the Treasury millions of dollars in lost revenue.
Fuck.
So
millions of old-timey dollars.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, whiskey's a big business. I mean, nobody wanted to drink water back then.
Yeah.
Okay? Take that into mind. People were drinking whiskey instead of water because it was safer.
Sure, old time people.
Can't get dysentery totally from whiskey, can you?
Well, I guess.
The VOMs.
True.
Now, in mid-April of 1875, Bristow gave Grant evidence of the whiskey ring. Grant left Washington to attend a centennial commemoration of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And hearing rumors of impending raids by Bristow, supervisor of the Internal Revenue, John McDonald, that old guy, who was in St. Louis, he decided to go to Washington, D.C. and kind of get out of there just in case anything was going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
Now, with evidence against him, McDonald broke down and confessed to Bristow. So that's one guy in the ring who's like, there's something going on. So with his confession, McDonald resigned on April 23rd. He returned to St. Louis. And then Grant returned and Bristow informed him of the full operation of the ring in person. So he's like, fuck.
Oops.
What do I do? So Bristow suggested that Grant fire Douglas for criminal negligence. And he was like, okay, that sounds good. So he complied. He fired Douglas on May 10th, 1875. Bristow started to conduct a series of raids across the nation to break up the ring. He started in St. Louis. So we have Douglas fired, McDonald resigned after confessing, and now they're trying to get the rest of the heads of the rings.
Okay.
By July of 1875, Bristow, with the assistance of Attorney General Edward Pierpont, were tasked with chairing an anti-corruption team for Grant. They're like, okay, this is going to be big news. This is a national scandal under your watch. So they decided to put this team together to kind of be like, we had nothing to do with this, and we're going to break it up.
Instant, like, just so you know, like, this wasn't us.
Yeah, wasn't me.
Oh, my God.
Big shaggy vibes. Yeah, wasn't me.
Wasn't me.
So they met with Grant to discuss Babcock, because Babcock also was found to have a little bit of a influence in this ring.
My God.
Babcock was actually very, very loyal to Grant. They went back all the way to the Civil War. They worked together. They were best fucking friends.
Okay.
Okay? Grant told Pierpont, let no guilty man escape. And he said, if Babcock was guilty, then it was the greatest piece of traitorism to me that a man could possibly practice.
Oof.
So, in October, Babcock was summoned in front of Grant, Bristow, and Pierpont at the White House to explain two really sketchy telegrams that were written, supposedly by Babcock, but signed SYLPH, which was an apparent code name, S-Y-L-P-H, SYLPH.
Ooh, okay.
Remember that for later.
Okay.
The first message read, I have succeeded. They will not go. I will write you. And that was sent in December of 1874.
Okay.
The second one said, we have official information that the enemy weakens. Push things. That was sent in February of 1875.
Okay.
So Babcock listened to this, read them. Then he pulled Grant aside and said a few things to him, which supposedly was an explanation. And Grant looked like he was satisfied. But no one else in the room heard the exchange between the men.
Oh, my God. This is so, all of this is like so mysterious and backhanded and like, oh, my gosh. Okay.
So Pierpont and Bristow insisted that Babcock send a message to the correspondents via telegraph in St. Louis demanding that this individual come to Washington to give his version of the story. They're like, okay. Tell him to come here. Tell us what you were saying, and we'll let it go.
Okay.
So he went ahead and started to draft a telegraph in the other room. But after Babcock seemed to be taking a really fucking long time, Bristow and Pierpont went in there to check on him and found that Babcock was writing a warning letter to revenue agent John Joyce, his St. Louis
no chill
assistant, I guess.
He's got no chill. He's like, oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck.
And he said in the note, be on guard.
Yeah, I did. It had to have been like total panic.
Yeah.
Like, oh, no.
So.
Oh, God.
Bristow and Pierpont were like, all right, well, we're going to have to fucking indict you on this conspiracy
would make for
charges.
A really good movie, I feel like.
It really would. So they indicted him on conspiracy to defraud the Treasury of the United States on November 4th, 1875. The trial was a little hectic. Grant appointed John B. Henderson as a special prosecutor in the investigation, hoping to kind of head off any criticism about conflicts of interest.
Okay.
Henderson was a former U.S. senator from Missouri. They worked together with the U.S. attorneys to start handing down indictments in the St. Louis ring. And he had no previous relationship with Grant whatsoever. So he's like, I'm going to pick a total rando and they're going to do it. So okay. That nobody thinks there's anything suspicious.
Yeah.
So the trial begins at Jefferson City, Missouri in 1875, October. The ringleader, John McDonald, was indicted immediately.
Of course.
David P. Dyer was the one who was really kind of handling things, and Henderson was like the head. McDonald was convicted, fined $5,000, and sentenced to prison for 18 months. So
okay.
Kind of a big deal. Revenue agent John A. Joyce, who was the St. Louis contact that Babcock kept talking to, was indicted, tried, convicted, and sentenced to the penitentiary. I could not find out how long he was sentenced to jail.
Okay.
That's but weird. It probably wasn't that long of a time.
Yeah.
But of course, Babcock, who was next in line for a trial, had the most interesting trial of them all.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
On February 8th, 1876, Babcock's trial started in St. Louis.
Okay.
It would only last 18 days, which is really short for this time period and the magnitude of scandal.
Yeah.
So Babcock's defense team was stacked. He had a former attorney general, George Williams, a top criminal defense advocate and lawyer, Emory A. Storrs, and a former appeals judge of New York, John K. Porter, on his team. And they were, like, wheeling and dealing and, like, trying to get him off.
Okay.
They demanded that the proceedings were only attended by a select few people because there was such, like, national coverage of this.
Yeah.
People were actually, like, trying to get in to watch the trial. Like, there were lines out the door. So what they wound up doing was giving out tickets to people who could come in. And if you didn't have a ticket, you couldn't view the trial.
Interesting. Like,
there were just so many fucking people trying to get in there.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, yeah.
I know that happens still on some cases today, but generally people get in a line. I mean, it's not just like you get one, you get one, you get one, but like you have to go and stand in fucking line outside the courthouse to like be let in.
Yeah, so people were like trying to bum rush the fucking courthouse to get in there to watch the stupid ass
trial.
They
can't stop all of us, can
they? Right? So they're like, if you don't have a golden ticket, you can't get in. So Grant actually gave written testimony from the White House for Babcock. He originally wanted to appear in person, but his team deemed that it was a really bad idea.
Yeah,
dude. Because it's like, hello.
Everyone's going to know where the president is.
Yeah. That's and also, you guys are good friends. They're going to think you're in cahoots.
Oh, yeah.
So Grant refused to testify against Babcock, despite having been informed by Bristow of Babcock's duplicity in the entire fucking situation. He's like, I decide to not agree with you on this. Like,
okay, yeah, okay, buddy.
So instead, Grant praised Babcock, saying he was a great confidant, he had integrity, he was, you know, just unshaken by how well Babcock worked. So on February 17th, the Grant deposition was read aloud to the jury, and I'm just going to read a small excerpt from it so you can kind of get an idea of like what the fuck is going on.
Okay.
The two lawyers, Eaton, Cook, and then President Grant is who's going to be talking. So Eaton said, "Have you ever seen anything in the conduct of General Babcock, or has he ever said anything to you which indicated to your mind that he was in any way interested in or concerned with the whiskey ring at St. Louis or elsewhere?" Grant, "Never." Eaton, "Did General Babcock on or about April 23rd, 1875, show you a dispatch in these words, St. Louis, April 23, 1875, General O.E. Babcock, Executive Mansion, Washington, D.C., tell Mac to see Parker of Colorado and telegram to Commissioner, crush out St. Louis enemies?" Cook objected, and then they made that in the record.
Okay.
Grant said, "I did not remember about these dispatches at all until since the conspiracy trials have commenced. I have heard General Babcock's explanation of most or all of them since then. Many of the dispatches may have been shown to me at the time and explained, but I do not remember it."
Okay.
Eaton, "Perhaps you are aware, General, that the whiskey ring has persistently tried to fix the origins of that ring and the necessity for funds to carry on political campaigns. Did you ever have intimidation from General Babcock or anyone else in any manner, directly or indirectly, that any funds or political purposes were being raised by any improper methods?" An objection was made again, made in the record. President Grant said, "I never did. I never seen since these trials intimations or intimidations of any sort in the newspapers, but never before." Eaton, "Then let me ask you, if the prosecuting officers have not entirely correct in repelling all insinuations that you've ever had tolerated any such means for raising funds?" This is a very old-timey talk.
Yeah.
Cook objects again. President Grant says, "I was not aware that they had ever attempted to repeal any insinuations." So what they're trying to say, let me decode
give me
this
the, give
for
me
you.
The TLDR on the dep.
So what they were saying is that they were raising all of this money and all these people were saving this money, and most of them are Republicans. And they stated that they were going to put some of this money around people who were running for offices to continue their scheme and to continue having, you know, breaks, government breaks, tax breaks.
So you're essentially paying off people in the Republican Party to complete their agenda when they're in office. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to run under all the things that they wanted.
Gotcha.
So that's what they're trying to get at. Now, Grant is a Republican.
Okay.
And I'll tell you a little bit about Republican history later on in this episode, but just keep that in mind.
Okay.
There's a really great etching of the trial, and you can see it's just like wall-to-wall old-timey men in there. After all the testimony was given and Grant said his words, a few other former Civil War soldiers kind of spoke on Babcock's behalf to kind of say that he was a really great person. Of course, all those Civil War guys, you know, those vets are going to stick together no matter what.
Yeah.
So Babcock was actually acquitted on February 25th.
Okay. Interesting.
However, in April of 1876, 51 days after his acquittal in the whiskey ring trial, Babcock was indicted again.
Okay.
This time for his involvement in the safe burglary conspiracy.
Oh, Jesus. This guy was like, please, I need all the fraud.
He needs to be all of so it. Corrupt.
All of it.
So this was a corrupt building contractor scheme in Washington, D.C.
Totally separate from the whiskey.
Totally different. God. Totally different.
How much time do you have?
There was some Secret Service agents working for contractors placing damaging evidence into safes of a couple district attorneys who were prosecuting the whiskey ring.
What?
So they were trying to put damning evidence into people's offices and their safes to get them to look like they're corrupt so that they couldn't participate in the whiskey ring, like, trials.
Oh, my God. This is so convoluted.
It is so unbelievably convoluted. On the night of April 23rd, 1874, a bunch of hired thieves opened safes using explosives to make it appear that the safe had been broken into.
Oh, my God.
So one of the thieves then took fake evidence to the house of Columbus Alexander, who was a citizen who was active in prosecuting the ring. The corrupt agents, quote unquote, arrested the quote unquote fake thieves, who then committed perjury by signing a document falsely stating Alexander was involved in the safe burglary.
Dude, so you're telling me this is just like the modus operandi for the Republican Party? Because like, Watergate. You're literally explaining this to me, and I'm just like, but Watergate? The same thing happens way later. Oh my God.
So, Babcock was involved in those two scandals. And then information came out after he got arrested for this one that he was involved in a gold scandal previous to 1874, as well as a bribery scandal involving a customs warehouse in New York who was charging extra fees and pocketing them to store goods.
Oh, God.
Okay. So that's four separate
that's so
scandals
much fraud.
He's involved in.
Can again, like, where do you find the time? To right? do, I can't
How are
even,
you frauding so hard?
I can't even not fraud.
Well, there were no TV, no phones back then. True. What are you going to do but fraud?
I guess.
Gonna fraud all the live long day.
Sunrise to sunset.
We be frauding.
Oh my God.
So on February 27th, 1877, after being acquitted on every single fucking fraud conspiracy, Grant decided to appoint Babcock inspector of lighthouses of the 5th District, which is the lowest possible position a person could have in the government.
Is it?
Yep.
Inspector of lighthouses.
Of the 5th District.
What is the 5th District?
It's up towards the top of New England.
Oh boy. Oh my God.
Now, both maintain loyalty and friendship to one another until the very fucking bitter end. That is why Grant appointed him the lowest position, because he couldn't like push him out of his life.
Yeah.
I feel like they had like more than a friendship. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like maybe there was a little bit of manly love.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
In 1884, Babcock would unfortunately drown on duty when he was thrown from a boat in harsh waves.
Wow. Dramatic.
Yes. Now, in 1880, MacDonald, who was one of the people who was tried and convicted, wrote a tell-all book about the ring.
Ooh.
MacDonald accused Babcock of adultery and revealed the origins of his Sylph signature.
Oh,
are you ready for this?
Okay, okay.
The plot thickens.
Yes.
According to MacDonald, when Babcock had attended the annual St. Louis Fair with John A. Joyce, the other guy who was convicted, they saw a very attractive woman while they were walking on Fifth Street, to whom Babcock nicknamed Sylph for her beauty. Although Babcock was married, he reportedly said to Joyce, "She's the most beautiful and bewitching woman I have ever saw. For heaven's sake, let us turn the corner and meet her again so that you can give me the introduction."
Oh my God.
Later at a restaurant, Joyce introduced Babcock to the woman, whose name was Lewis Lou Hawkins. And when they developed a friendship, it later became intimate, according to MacDonald. Babcock later used the Sylph as a code signature in correspondences with Joyce.
Saucy! Oh my God. Okay.
So not only is he a hardcore fraudster, he's also a hardcore adulterer. Ultimately, of the 238 individuals indicted in the Whiskey Ring case, 110 would be convicted.
Damn.
And more than $3 million of stolen tax revenues were recovered.
Wow. That's impressive.
Grant's presidency was marred with tons of scandals. I'm going to read you a short list.
Okay.
The 1869 Black Friday scandal, the 1872 House New York Customs House ring, the 1872 Star Route Postal ring, the 1872 salary grab, the 1874 breach of Treaty of Fort Laramie,
oof,
the 1874 Sanborn moiety extortion, that's a hard word to say, the 1875 Secretary Delano Department of Interior scandal, the 1875 U.S. Attorney General William DOJ scandal.
Oh, my God.
The 1876 whiskey ring. The 1876 Secretary Belknap's Department of War scandal.
There's a man, he really jammed a lot into his term.
I'm not done. There's two more. The 1876 Secretary Robeson's Department of Navy scandal. And the 1876 safe burglary conspiracy.
Wow. That is quite the record.
Yep. And he had nothing to do with any of them. It was all people he fucking appointed.
Poor guy.
You know, you have some friends, my dude. But also, what do your friends say about you? That's always the old saying.
True. I mean,
if you surround yourself with thieves, you too are a thief.
Or at least an idiot.
Yeah. So after the Whiskey Ring scandal came out, the attitudes towards the Republican Party shifted, and they were deemed corrupt and money-grabbing. President Grant at the time was deemed one of the worst presidents. Now take it. He was only the 18th president. Worst one. Number 18.
Well.
And this.
I mean, it's been blown out of the water now. Right. But.
But this was actually the time when the Republican Party platform actually switched.
Okay.
So prior to this, they were actually what you would consider a Democrat, a liberal.
Yeah, it was totally flip-flopped back in the day.
It flipped right during Grant's presidency.
Interesting.
So, this is when they started to become the party that we all know today. Yeah.
Oofa doofa.
And this is actually the time when the newspapers started really talking about Republican corruption. So, you can thank President for Grant for that.
Thanks, Grant.
Less than a year after Babcock died in 1884, Grant was diagnosed with throat cancer and passed away in 1885.
Bummer.
And that is the story of the whiskey ring and the most quote-unquote corrupt, fraudulent time period of U.S. presidential history.
Not heard of any of that. But as you're talking about these people breaking into places, I'm literally like, the parallels with Watergate were crazy.
Yes. Nothing's changed in the old Republican Party. Everybody be stealing paperwork and doing scammers all kinds of scamming.
So I decided to look this time at frauds are really interesting because, like, there's some really small cases out there, and then there's some really huge, extensive cases.
Yeah.
Trying to find something in the middle is real tricky. But I managed to land on the story of Sholem Weiss and the collapse of the National Heritage Life Insurance Company.
Oh, life insurance.
Yeah.
What a scheme.
I mean, insurance, am I right?
Right. Why do we have it? Why do we need it?
So Sholem Weiss was raised in New York and attended a Yiddish language yeshiva as a child. Mm-hmm. He didn't actually learn English until he was in his teens.
What year is this?
So this would have been in the late 60s.
Oh, okay. I was like, this is early 1900s?
No, that's really
commonplace.
No, this is like the late 60s, but it's like
60s. Yikes.
Like Orthodox Jewish New York. Mm-hmm.
Just a whole nother world.
Right, right. Later, Weiss began working construction before buying Windsor Plumbing Supply in the early 70s at 20 years old.
Okay. Couldn't even buy a house at 20 years old.
Yeah, right? I don't want to talk about
how millennials are fucked for all of eternity. It's fine.
Now, according to the New York Times, the Windsor was bringing in around $275,000 a year at the time that it was purchased, but was doing $20 million just over 10 years after Weiss purchased it. So he increased the business.
That's a lot.
$275,000 to $20 million.
That is a lot.
That is a lot. So obviously, like, he's got some business sense, right? Mm-hmm. However, soon after that, the company was facing increasing debt and bankruptcy, essentially.
Okay.
And so just a few years later, it was forced to close. Now, Weiss, who had married and started a family in that time, moved the entire family to Muncie, New York, and eventually divorced his wife after they had been married for 14 years. Now, again, from the New York Times, I thought this was kind of interesting. This is some rich people shit, right?
Yeah.
Quote, then a wealthy man, Mr. Weiss signed a separation agreement that left his wife well provided for and included a proviso that he pay for a bar mitzvah and or wedding for each of their 5 children, spending no less than $100,000 for each event.
Wow. It's a lot.
What kind of bar
mitzvah? $100,000 for a bar mitzvah?
Yeah.
I can see a wedding.
Yeah.
But a bar mitzvah?
Yeah. For his next business venture, Weiss decided to sell his expertise in business by becoming a bankruptcy specialist who would give advice to other businessmen.
Peter Francis Geraci. I'm Peter Francis Geraci.
Oh, no, my God.
Chapter 11.
How funny is it that there are just certain things that will trigger these memories?
Yes.
Peter Francis Geraci, that motherfucker.
Infotapes. Call Infotapes now.
Pretty much that.
Yeah.
It was during this time that Weiss met attorney Michael D. Blutrich. Now, Blutrich owned a topless club.
Ooh, named, classy.
His name Scores.
Okay, all right.
That was controlled at the time by the Gambino crime family.
I was going to say, oh, here comes the mob. Mob loves a titty bar. Yeah.
So that was controlled by the Gambinos. Mm-hmm. He was also employed as outside counsel for the National Heritage Life Insurance Company.
Outside counsel, okay.
Mm-hmm. Outside counsel. And with that, the fateful meeting of Weiss and this guy, this attorney, was on track to their future fraud together.
Okay.
really
planning
his,
the
his
frauds.
Sort of yeah, first yeah. venture was when Weiss attempted to defraud his insurance company by falsely claiming that more than $1 million in bathtubs had sustained damage during a 1986 warehouse fire at his company.
Okay. Okay. Small.
So in 1994, he was indicted on various mail fraud charges and was sent to a Manhattan federal court for trial. During this trial, Weiss's associate, Blutrich, actually attempted to, like, help him by going to the prosecution and giving them false information to try to, like, get him off the hook. But it didn't work. And he received 8 months in prison for fraud for that.
Of course.
By 1996, Weiss had been released and was living in a halfway house. He was able to persuade federal probation officers to grant him a 4-day furlough so he could spend Passover with his wife and kids.
Okay. Okay. Back when you could furlough the shit out of everything.
Right. Now, again, from the New York Times, quote, he persuaded Donald J. Trump's Atlantic City Hotel and Casino to fly him and a 23-year-old companion by Learjet to the gambling resort, where they stayed in a complimentary $700 a night suite and wagered $70,000.
Okay.
And so they were like, that's not what you said.
That's not
like,
Passover.
That's not Passover. That's how we gave you this.
That is the
for.
Opposite of Passover. You're not supposed to do anything.
So he was arrested.
Good.
And he was charged initially and, like, was in trouble for this little stunt, but the charges were eventually dropped and he just, like, didn't get in trouble for it. Okay.
That's very lucky.
So now we're going to back up a little bit. That was kind of the background on Weiss. But we do need to back up a little bit in time to talk about National Heritage Life Insurance Company, because there was, like, a bunch of shit going on.
That name in and of itself just sounds like it's a shell company.
Yeah, there was a bunch of shit going on before Weiss even, like, showed up in
the
picture.
It's like they just picked random names to name it. National Heritage.
All of the companies that I'm about to mention are like that. It's just let's smash words together.
Pull them out of a hat.
So this chunk of my research is mainly from this really great article. It's called Anatomy of a Failure by Sally Whitney. I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay. What a title.
Yeah. And things are now about to turn into this very tangled web. So, like, okay. Strap in.
All right. Gotta put my thinking cap on.
So we're going to step back into the 1980s a little bit.
Okay.
National Heritage is, so it was chartered in Delaware, but the majority of their business is in Florida.
As you do.
With a couple other states. They sell life insurance.
Yeah. Probably a tax loophole. Delaware is a really big tax haven in the U.S.
President Biden. So they were largely a Florida-based company that dealt in mainly universal life policies. However, by 1989, there was a drop in sales and the company suffered significant losses. Now, in May 1990...
Sorry, it just came into my brain. It's like, people aren't dying like they used to.
Oh, God.
I don't know why. People aren't dying like they used to.
I mean, ideally, they're buying the insurance policies before they die. So in May 1990, the Delaware Insurance Department began to become concerned about the solvency of Heritage and threatened to take regulatory action if they weren't able to acquire additional capital to, like, make sure that they had these assets to
actually pay out the life insurance.
Right. Enter three dudes, David Davies, Lambert Aloisi.
Fake names.
And Patrick Smith.
Fake names.
Spelled with a Y.
Smythe.
They were the creators of Tri Holdings Limited. I'm sorry, Tri Atlantic Holdings Limited.
Everything is fake in this story.
So they decided to... Those are all their real names, by the way.
I know. I figured as much, but they just sound perfectly fake. They do sound...
David Davies. Like,
right?
Yeah.
I'm Janelle Janelles.
John Johnson. They sent a letter as Tri-Atlantic to Heritage's parent company, Lifeco. So this... All
that sounds
real.
Like an Adult Swim fake fucking company. Lifeco.
So they send a letter to this parent company saying they were willing to provide $4 million in liquid assets in exchange for a controlling interest in both Lifeco and Heritage.
Okay.
And shit at Heritage was getting real. I mean, it was like, we're kind of fucked without this. So they decided to accept the offer. Okay. Little did they know, these assets did not exist.
So liquid, they vaporized. Yes.
Don't worry. They're going to make them exist.
Okay.
We talked about manifesting. They are just going to manifest.
Come to me, liquid assets.
So I might skip a few things in this because it does get kind of technical. And
right.
Like,
are we life insurance agents?
No. And there's a lot. There is a lot of shit like yours. Like, there's a lot of just like random shit that's happening. Mm-hmm. So first, Davies takes $540,000 from a trust fund, one of his trust funds, and it was transferred to Tri-Atlantic. Okay. $525,000 of that was used to purchase $4.5 million of U.S. Treasury notes on margin. What does that mean? I don't know. It's something with loans and having this capital guarantee behind
the government. It's the government.
Something about
I inherited notes.
I mean, I had bonds. I definitely got bonds. But like, I don't know. It's again, this is outside some of my scope. So there's something that happens with using those bonds as assurance for a stock purchase.
Okay.
In, I believe, Lifeco, but in this sort of like insurance with the bonds, they failed to note that the bonds were pledged as collateral for the margin loan with which they were purchased.
Okay.
You with me so far?
Yes. Barely, but yes.
So then our old pal, Blue Trich, the attorney of the titty bar, the attorney of the titty bar, shows up into this whole thing. He opens up another account at the same bank under the name Capital Comparisons.
So many fucking weird name businesses.
So then there is this money being wired between Tri-Atlantic And Capital Comparisons is like going back and forth. And what ends up happening is that Blutrich shows up to the Tri-Atlantic Life Co. closing of them buying the company with a check for $4 million.
Yeah, okay. What?
Drawn on his own account. Okay. At this point, there was not – there was only $1 million in his account.
Manifesting.
Okay. Truly. So what this did is because he showed up with this check – we all know how checks work.
We do.
The closing, they completed the closing before cashing the check, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it allowed them to allow Tri-Atlantic to immediately appoint Davies, Smith, and Aloisi to the board of both companies, which then allowed them to delay the depositing of the check. Mm-hmm. Of the check.
Otherwise, it would bounce so hard.
So then they did some more finagling and like moving this money around, and the group was able to essentially purchase Heritage with Heritage's own funds. And in the process...
Awesome. Write a check to myself for myself.
Yeah. And in the process, they reduced Heritage's assets by $4 million.
So dumb.
So it was just like it's very... Later, they describe it as essentially a check-kiting scheme where you're kind of like paying it forward almost. You're like using the money incoming to cover this thing.
Kinda, yeah, like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
Like you buy the product with your own money to hopefully make back the money that you spent on the product. Mm-hmm.
So then they had to cover up this missing money. Mm-hmm. And so Blutrich, Davies, Aloisi, Smith, and Blutrich covered up this missing money by faking investments in various ventures and loans, most of which involved companies controlled by these four guys and some of the other fraudsters. Now, the reason I'm not going into like every single, that's just like one piece of it. That was very complicated. Because by the time investigators like discovered what was going on, there were at least 18 schemes that had their hold on Heritage. To just like, they would be like, okay, so we started with this. We need to cover up this money, but then we need to cover up the cover up, and then we have to cover up the cover up to the cover up, but then we need to cover up the cover up to the cover up to the cover up.
Like, you know, and it was just and so cover up, so Steve. Yeah.
It's like the Russian nesting dolls of cover-ups. So Weiss actually enters the picture in 1993 when he joins up with the group of guys like perpetrating this elaborate check-kiting scheme on a life insurance company. Weiss used his company to purchase completely worthless stocks and mortgages, providing Weiss with millions in his bank account and just like sucking money from Heritage. The group manages to make it appear as if National Heritage was able to get $126 million in assets for $18
million. Okay.
Somehow. Creative accounting. At some point, the U.S. Attorney's Office manages to develop an informant within the organization who notified them about possible bad stuff going on.
There's
there's some weird things going on. By this point, the Delaware Insurance Department had also like started its own inspection. Like they saw some weird shit going on and were like, we're going to start looking into this. And that's like the regulatory commission in Delaware State. So they started their own inspection of the insurance company, quickly finding out that something was up when no one could produce the documents that they were requesting.
Of course.
The federal authorities began investigating National Heritage, eventually creating a joint task force in 1995 made up of the FBI and the Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS that would look at this various players in this whole scheme across Arizona, Texas, Illinois, New York, and Florida.
Okay.
So it very quickly turned into a fraud ring of sorts.
Yeah.
Now, during these investigations, National Heritage was placed in receivership and they eventually had to be liquidated in 1995. Now, there were approximately 35,000 policyholders, many of which lost their life savings.
Oh, my God.
In this. Now, they were able, I think in the end, they were able to recover something like $420 million of this and like did recoup a large cost to these people that had these policies. But
not enough.
Yeah. Now, Weiss was indicted on various felony counts, including racketeering, money laundering, and fraud. The government did offer him a plea deal in which Weiss was, he would serve 5 years in prison in exchange for a guilty plea.
Okay.
Okay. Does that sound good to you or no?
I mean,
I'm curious what your take on this.
What would have been the max that you could get?
Well, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it would depend on what the max is.
So he didn't take the plea deal, opting instead to go to trial. The trial started in 1999. Both sides presented their case, and the jury heads off for deliberation. Then, on one Sunday in October, Weiss shows up for his, like, normal pre-trial check-in. He has to do this because he's out on bond. Mm-hmm. And then he completely disappears.
Okay, well.
Okay. Yeah. It was
clear. That would throw a wrench into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was clear Weiss had decided to flee the country.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So now they're searching for this fugitive. The jury was still in deliberations. Like, they are still continuing the trial. They're mid-trial. Yeah. They eventually come back with a guilty verdict. Mm-hmm. Weiss was sentenced in absentia, receiving a total of 825 years in prison.
Probably wouldn't have got that.
Like, 5 years sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I feel like that seems excessive, though.
It is fraud. It is a lot, yeah. Mm-hmm. In comparison, Bernie Madoff received 150 years in 2009 after a guilty plea. He pleaded guilty. And even then, like, people were like, that's really excessive for him.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, with his, though, people, like, killed themselves.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there was technically life lost.
Yeah. Although legally, is he responsible for that?
That is the question.
Yeah. Anyway, so the judge also imposed a $123,399,910 in fines.
I feel like that's what you have to do when you're dealing with fraud.
Yeah.
Is stick it with the fines real hard.
And $125,016,656 in restitution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And, like, not allow them to participate in any financial sector whatsoever. Right. You know? Right. Like, really.
Yeah. There was another case that I was looking at where the person got suspended, but they could, like, reapply for reconsideration after, like, 5 years or something. Okay. So I wonder if that's, like, the – if you have to, like, ban somebody, they can apply again later. But even still, like, then at least you have the opportunity to say no.
Yeah.
Now, meanwhile, Weiss, who somehow, I'm sure through, like, offshore bank accounts and stuff, still has access to millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's the thing is, like, that's what you really need to do is, like, get all of the assets they could conceivably have, even if it's offshore.
Yeah.
That's, and that's you the, really stick it
that's
to them.
The tricky part, too, is, like, the offshore bank accounts. So he was fleeing across the globe with his 27-year-old Brazilian girlfriend. Now, according to another New York Times article, quote, Mr. Weiss seldom stayed in one place, using prepaid cell phones, mounds of cash, and a series of false identities to elude authorities in South America, Europe, and Israel. Now, of course, rich people are going to need rich shit. So yeah,
they can't just live a normal mid-class life.
Yeah. So he was, like, living it up in these fancy five-star hotels. He was, like, still going out to fine dining, also partaking in gambling and prostitution while he was on the road.
As you do.
Now, authorities were able to track Weiss down thanks to his Brazilian girlfriend.
Uh-oh.
She was actually, they started following her because she was seen in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so they followed her from Sao Paulo to Budapest because she was going to Budapest via Frankfurt.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So she was going to Frankfurt and then going to Budapest. However, when she got there, she instead decided to take a train to Vienna. And this is where, like, she met up with Weiss, who then took her to this apartment that he had just rented in Vienna. And so police show up to the apartment in Vienna, picked him up, arrested him. He, in some of the articles, they talk about him not saying, like, the first thing he said was not, like, what are you doing here? Like, the first thing he said was, I want my attorney, which is like, okay, you know what's up.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. So they were able to pick him up. They extradited him back to the United States in 2002. In total, 3 corporations and 13 individuals, including Davies, Smith, Blutrich, and Weiss, were convicted in connection to the fraud. And National Heritage is believed to be the largest insurance fraud in history.
Wow.
It's wild.
It's a big deal.
Now, as usual, if you thought that was the end of it, you'd be wrong. Now, like you, many people took issue with the length of the sentence. And just like I did, a lot of people compare it to that of Bernie Madoff, who is like the other large scale fraud really in the U.S. that you can compare it to, right?
Yeah.
And 850 years is a lot because she essentially, for the charges, it was like 20 years separately stacked.
Yeah.
So there was this like campaign to get Weiss's sentence commuted and to get some sort of clemency. Mm-hmm. So, of course, he had many connections to like people in the political sphere, including Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, U.S. Attorney General Edwin Meese, former U.S. Solicitor General Seth Waxman, and the infamous Alan Dershowitz.
Mm, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Old Dershy.
But it turns out that Weiss just needed to wait for the right guy to get into office.
Uh-oh. Spoiler alert.
So through more connections.
Isn't he the one that stayed somewhere in particular?
Through more connections, Weiss's plight made it to the ears of Mark Meadows, who was former President Trump's chief of staff. And he sort of like brought Weiss's case to Trump's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Then on his final day in office, on January 19th, 2021, Trump commuted Weiss's sentence along with 72 others with an additional 70 pardons. If you remember, that was like big day. I'm pretty sure. I think that Bernie Madoff might have been in that. I can't remember if he was earlier or if it was during that round. But
I don't recall that
Bernie Madoff was also a Trump.
You don't say. So weird how he is surrounded by so many dirt bags.
Also, fucking Rod Blagojevich was a Trump.
Well.
Yeah.
What do you expect?
Anyway, so he, when he was asked about why he decided to pick Weiss as somebody he wanted to commute, he said he chose Weiss because he was 66 years old and suffered from chronic health conditions. Now, if it makes you feel better, 2 months after he was released, he had a massive stroke.
I mean, that makes me feel better, but like, it's karmic.
Yes, it is karmic. He did suffer a massive stroke. It was very serious. As far as I'm aware, he is still living it up somewhere. I didn't see any reports of his death or like any major like health events after this like massive stroke.
Mm-hmm.
But that is sort of the story about National Heritage. If you want to know more about the insurance-y side of things, that article, Anatomy of a Failure, that goes way more into like the specifics of how they moved this money around and the mortgages and investments and whatever other adult bullshit is like.
Yeah, too hard for me to comprehend.
Yeah. So That's the story.
Dang, makes you never want to buy life insurance.
Right?
I have life insurance through work. It's fine.
Yeah, me too.
Good enough. Throw me in a ditch, as I say. Just throw me in a ditch.
Well, before you decide to buy life insurance.
Before you thrust yourself into a ditch.
Maybe check out this podcast.
My name is Hunter.
And I'm Haley. And we're your hosts of
Murder and Such, a podcast about true crime, serial killers, and other dark subject matter. Join us while we fill your ear holes with some crappy comedy and disgusting tales.
You can now find us on Spotify,
iTunes,
Stitcher,
Podbean,
and all of your podcatcher services. You can like us on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter.
At Murder and Such.
Hope to hear from you guys soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, Janelle, that has been our show.
Ready for a whiskey and to go buy some insurance?
I'm ready for a nap is what I'm ready for.
Right.
Do we have anything coming up? Right now, right?
No.
Yeah, we just had, thanks to Side Street Studio Arts for putting on Dark Matters and for Ghostly for doing our audio. That was such a good time. It's always good to have a live show.
Yeah, it's good. And we meet some new people, some podcasts we haven't heard before. And
Yeah.
Fun times.
All right. I mean, do you want to say any advice for our listeners? Like, do you have sage wisdom before we close?
Flee to the forest. Don't participate in society. I don't know. That's how I feel currently.
Sure. On that
Make weird stuff.
Make weird I like stuff that.
And weirder friends. How
make,
about that?
Yeah, that's good. Make weird stuff and make weirder friends. On that note, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fulman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, The Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
We bid you adieu.
Bid you adieu.
Yeah, bid you.
Yeah.
Over this town. We are all.